Hey, 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 it's Al, and the worst secret in the multiverse is that I am a huge, huge comic book fan. I am such a comic book nerd that I am looking at all the comics I have spread out on my floor that I have to, like, put in order in their little boxes. I mean, seriously, uber nerd, I love it. And guess what? Reveal made a comic book. We paired beautiful illustrations by T. Bowie with our powerful stories about inequities revealed by the pandemic. So we have this limited time offer. If you donate $50, we'll send you a copy. Just text the word comic to 474747. You can text stop at any time. Standard data rates apply. Again, just text the word comic to 474747. True believers, thank you.
Reveal is brought to you by Progressive, one of the country's leading providers of auto insurance. With Progressive's Name Your Price tool, you say what kind of coverage you're looking for and how much you want to pay. And Progressive will help you find options that fit within your budget. Use the Name Your Price tool and start an online quote today at progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Camille Stanley, filling in for Al Lutzen. Al's working on a big series that you're going to be hearing a lot more about in the coming months. I'm the executive producer of Witness Docs from Stitcher. We make great podcasts about complicated people. Today on Reveal, change. How do we make it happen?
We have to come together.
President Biden speaking this month before a joint session of Congress.
To root out systemic racism in our criminal justice system and enact police reform in George Floyd's name.
Police reform. It's one of those phrases that gets thrown around a lot. But what does it really mean? What does real reform look like? It's been just a few weeks since former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty for the murder of George Floyd. And already, it's hard to keep track of all the police killings that have happened since. So, as the nation grapples with police reform, we're going to look at a region where it's been fought over, maybe more than anywhere else, for the last 6 years. It's the place where I live, St. Louis. It was August 2014 when Michael Brown was killed by then Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. Michael Brown was 18, black, and unarmed. And for many black people here, his death was a turning point.
It was the singular date that changed the trajectory of my life, and that was the day Mike Brown was murdered.
Kayla Reed was 24 years old at the time. She lived less than a mile from where Michael Brown was killed. She was working two jobs, as a pharmacy tech and a clerk at a local furniture store.
I was at that store when I heard about Mike Brown being killed and that his body was still on the ground several hours after the incident.
The whole time she was at work, Kayla was glued to her phone, watching social media and messaging a friend.
We were texting about it, and he said we should go to Ferguson. And so we went.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
And I just kind of found myself wanting to be in solidarity with the people who were mourning and a deep rage.
Kayla would get off work in the evening and then head straight to Ferguson to join protest until 2 or 3 a.m., she'd grab a few hours of sleep and then do it all again the next day. This was her routine for months.
I don't think anyone went out in August of 2014 thinking that they were starting a movement or understanding what it meant to start a movement.
Ferguson launched a movement and inspired a new generation of leaders. Kayla's one of them.
I wasn't an abolitionist. I wasn't a black feminist. I didn't have a critique of capitalism. I was just a person who lived in St. Louis who understood that Mike Brown shouldn't have died that day.
In the wake of Michael Brown's death, there were studies, reports, blue ribbon commissions, and countless police reform efforts. Many came up shorter than promised. But the seeds that were planted in the streets of Ferguson are beginning to grow. Today, in a partnership with the Missouri Independent, we'll look at how reformers in St. Louis are finding new ways to transform policing. Reveal's Trey Bundy begins our story.
After Michael Brown's death, Kayla Reed quit her jobs and dedicated herself to fighting for police reform. But she had a lot to learn.
I hadn't really dug deep into the organizations that fueled the civil rights movement, the kind of growth of that history. And even more than that, I lived the inequality in St. Louis. I didn't know how it came to be.
The more she learned, the more she began to see systemic racism at play.
You don't know that you're breathing bad air until someone tells you, because that's just what you've been in.
Just as Kayla was diving into activism, Jay Nixon, then governor of Missouri, held a press conference to announce what he said would be a sweeping response to the killing of Michael Brown.
Good afternoon. Throughout the history of our nation, we have struggled to treat all our citizens as equals.
Nixon's critics had blamed him for sending the National Guard to Ferguson and escalating violence against protesters. Now, he was calling those protesters changemakers.
The protests set in motion by the events of August 9th in Ferguson echo others within our lifetime. Across the decades, those protests have been a cry from the heart. That is why today I'm announcing the creation of the Ferguson Commission.
The Ferguson Commission would bring together educators, community leaders, and experts in health and law enforcement. They would study inequity and systemic racism in St. Louis and issue a report the governor promised would be a blueprint for reform. Nixon's office asked Reverend Starsky Wilson, a prominent Black community leader, to help lead the commission. And during its first meeting, Reverend Wilson said the eyes of the world were on this work.
But more than anything else, the eyes of our region, our neighbors, our friends, our families, our church members are upon us. Because our work will affect their life outcomes first and foremost.
It would take months for the commission to finish its report, but Kayla wasn't waiting around. She and other activists ramped up the fight for police reform. One of the first items on their list? A civilian oversight board to make police more accountable to the public. Police fight hard against civilian oversight, and police in St. Louis have staved it off for decades.
The Public Safety Committee meeting is now called to order. Mr. Clerk, please call the roll.
It's January 2015, and Kayla's at City Hall for a now infamous meeting over a civilian oversight bill.
And we were in this hearing. I was 25. We had packed the hearing. So many people had come to testify.
The place is full, and people stand shoulder to shoulder. They take turns at the microphone.
So we have a lot of opportunities to dig ourselves out of the racist hellhole that we have with institutional racism here in St. Louis, and particularly the way our police department functions, to do something very different.
Almost an hour into the meeting, an off-duty police officer gets up to speak.
My name is David Rudolph, and I'm a commissioned police officer for the city of St. Louis. I'm a member of the St. Louis Police Officers Association.
He's there on behalf of the union and says that tensions have been high since Ferguson.
Those tensions are what the men and women of the police services live every single day they patrol our streets.
The police union helped kill a similar bill back in 2006. And Rudolph says they don't like this one either. He says it's hostile toward law enforcement.
Police are not perfect, nor do we hold ourselves out to be. But we do put our lives on the line every day. And please be respectful.
What?
People start speaking out. It's tense. This is just 5 months after Ferguson. To a lot of people, civilian oversight has become a life and death issue. You can hear the anger in the room as more officers get up to speak against the bill. Then, the spokesperson for the police union yells out. That's Jeff Rorta. He's the public face of the St. Louis Police Officers Association. On the anniversary of Michael Brown's death, he posted on social media, "Happy Alive Day, Darren," to Darren Wilson, the officer who killed Michael Brown. At the meeting, he's wearing a wristband in support for Wilson. He's been walking around, showing it off and riling people up. So when he calls for order, it doesn't go over well, and the chairman fires back.
Pardon me. First of all, you do not tell me my function.
That's right.
You know, someone turns around to address Jeff Warder, and he shoves someone, a woman, a black woman, and the whole room just erupted.
You white supremacist motherfucker! Fuck you, Warder! Fuck you, polices! You're a piece of shit!
Yeah, chairs were being thrown around. It was a lot going on.
We asked Jeff Warder about this incident, but he didn't respond. Eventually, some people are cleared from the room, but those inside are still on edge.
They called my name to testify, like, immediately after that. They were like, oh, next on the list is Kayla Reed. And I was like, that is me. And I'm still trying to get people sitting down. So, like, hold on just for a second.
Either we're gonna continue this meeting, or we're not going to continue the meeting.
We're going to continue the meeting.
Okay. So, Ms. Reed, it's eating into her time. So...
Okay. So the bill that we have right now is definitely something that's necessary.
As she's talking, Kayla can't get the incident with Rorta out of her mind. He's the union spokesperson, and he just got physical with a woman in a public meeting. To Kayla, it was exactly the kind of impunity she hoped the Civilian Oversight Board would put in check.
I was shaking, and because I was so angry, I was viscerally, pissed off.
If you kill someone, regardless if a badge is on your chest or not, the law says murder makes you should have to go to jail for that. You should be
3 months after the meeting at City Hall, and just 8 months after Michael Brown was killed, the Civilian Oversight Bill passes. It's a major victory for organizers like Kayla, who are trying to put a stop to police killings. But then came the reality.
It ultimately passed, and it exists in the city, but it hasn't stopped people from being killed.
St. Louis Metropolitan Police shoot more people per capita than any other force in the country. Since Ferguson, they've shot at least 53 people, and at least 27 have died. But since it started 5 years ago, the Civilian Oversight Board hasn't investigated any of those shootings. Zero. They've never done it. Why? Because in St. Louis, police reform is so fraught with conflict and mistrust that it's really easy to knock it off course. For example, these cases begin inside the police department with cops investigating cops. When the police are done, the circuit attorney reviews the case. That's the city's top prosecutor. She tells us that many of these investigations are so incomplete that she can't sign off on them. So they stall out in her office and never make it to the Civilian Oversight Board. Another problem comes down to the paperwork. The police department refuses to use a joint complaint form, one that would ensure the Civilian Oversight Board gets a copy. For the 3 years starting in 2016, the board says more than 95% of citizen complaints against police never made it to their office. We asked the police department about this, but they didn't get back to us. These procedural problems have stopped the Civilian Oversight Board from carrying out its mission to hold police accountable. It's one of many examples since Ferguson of police reforms that haven't added up to real change.
A local commission today released a blunt new report. The 16-member Ferguson Commission issued 189 calls to action.
Remember the Ferguson Commission? That big effort to improve equity and public safety after Michael Brown was killed? Its final report wasn't really about police policies. Out of 189 calls to action, about a dozen were aimed at police reform, and none of them have successfully been put in place. Most of the report was focused on improving education, housing, health, economic opportunity, initiatives the commission believed would make underserved communities safer. And it identified a key barrier to all of that: systemic racism.
I think I know much more clearly who to trust and who not to.
Reverend Starsky Wilson, who helped lead the Ferguson Commission, he talked about the report on the local podcast Under the Arch and how systemic racism dominates the city's institutions.
That's not going to be broken with the best policy papers, and that's not going to be broken through educational advancement. It's going to be broken by really powerful communities being able to bend systems to their own will and to their interests.
That vision of communities taking the reins of power had begun to shape Kayla's approach to reform. The longer she fought to change policing in St. Louis, the more she came to believe that chipping away at police reform was not the best way to save Black lives.
In 2015, what we were responding to were these like individual cases of police brutality. So in Mike Brown's case, there was no camera. And so people asked for body cameras. The officer was white, so people asked for more diversity, right? There was no consequence to the officer, so people asked for civilian oversight. But each of those solutions, more training, diversity, cameras, civilian oversight, only add more money to the police and can be derailed and controlled by the police union.
Kayla started out like countless other demonstrators, drawn into the street to protest the killing of a Black man in her city. Now, she was seeing a bigger picture. It was all about political power. And the police were the ones who had it.
People are only going to do this thing if they understand that you hold power.
Kayla knew that if she and her allies wanted systemic change, they couldn't just fight the system. What they really needed to do was take it over.
That was Reveal's Trey Bundy. Later in the show, we'll come back to Kayla Reed as she and her allies set their sights on City Hall. But first, we're going to tell you the story of Black police officers in St. Louis trying to change their department from the inside.
Unfortunately, that was a mission of trying to empty the ocean with a teacup. It's just a mission impossible.
That's coming up on Reveal.
From C13 Original Studio comes a new documentary podcast series called Fate of Fact, written and narrated by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and best-selling author John Meacham. America has always been a country of competing visions, a nation shaped by the push and pull of vigorous debate. But now, that fragile consensus to find truth feels fundamentally broken. Join John Meacham in Fate of Fact as he explores how and why fear and power have conquered truth, and why respect for data and fact has become a casualty of war in the United States. Fate of Fact, a new audio documentary from Shining City Audio, John Meacham, and C13 Original Studio, is available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, and wherever you get your podcasts. Reveal is brought to you by Progressive, one of the country's leading providers of auto insurance. With Progressive's Name Your Price tool, you say what kind of coverage you're looking for and how much you want to pay. And Progressive will help you find options that fit within your budget. Use the Name Your Price tool and start an online quote today at progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We know that some of our listeners are journalists themselves. If you're a reporter, consider joining Reveal's reporting networks. When we release big investigations, we often have tons of material, documents, tips, data, Reporters who are part of our networks get access to that, so you can use it to keep digging in your own community. And the best part, it's all completely free. To join, just text the word network to 474747. Standard data rates apply, and you can text STOP at any time. Again, if you're a reporter who wants to join, just text the word network to 474747.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Camille Stanley, in for Al Letson. St. Louis leads the nation in police killings per capita, and more than two-thirds of those killed by police are Black men. Today, we're partnering with the Missouri Independent to look at how the movement for police accountability has evolved since Ferguson. And you can't talk about police reforms here without talking about the role of the city's main police union. The St. Louis Police Officers Association has consistently pushed back against community-led reform. And the more we dug, the more we realized that pushing back against accountability, well, it has a lot to do with how the union got its start in the first place. For St. Louis resident James Buchanan, it's a personal story, one that dates back to a Sunday in 1955.
I do recall my dad had a tie on. My mother was dressed, and we had our church clothes on, and we were all three in the back seat.
Buchanan was sitting with his two younger sisters in the back seat of his family's Buick Roadmaster. He was just 12 years old at the time, coming back from church when his dad went through an intersection.
This police officer, he stopped my dad, pulled him over.
Buchanan says the St. Louis police officer asked his dad, "Didn't you see that stop sign?" And he used the racial epithet, calling his dad the N-word.
And my dad looked at him and said, "Well, officer, whatever the problem is," he said, "if you would be kind enough to be courteous to my family and children here, I wish you wouldn't use that word."
Buchanan says the officer repeated his question, "Didn't you see that stop sign?" And for the second time, he called his dad the N-word.
And so with that, my dad got out of the car and he says, "Get your black ass back into that car."
Buchanan was there in the back seat watching all of this unfold.
My mother got out of the car and stepped in between the policeman and my dad, and the officer drew his weapon, and it was pointing towards my mother's chest. And I just had this flash of this white police officer mowing down my mother and father, and I was terrified. I was actually traumatized for almost my entire lifetime, thinking how closely my mother and father came to getting killed by a police officer.
This incident changed his life. It's part of why, after he graduated high school, he decided to become a police officer himself.
My mother she had a conniption. She said, "That's the last thing that I want you to do, is to be a police officer."
His father had a different take.
My dad was thrilled about it. His thought was, if there were black people involved, that would make a difference.
Buchanan became a St. Louis police officer in 1965, just a decade after that incident with his family in the car. During his first 3 years on the job, one local activist group reported that police shot and killed 23 black civilians. Tensions between police and the black community were on the rise.
These things were going on all the time. You know, the brutality complaints, the incident that took place in the 9th District Station.
The incident at the 9th District Station involved the St. Louis Police Department and a local civil rights group called the Black Liberators.
Well, we were called militants, agitators, anything that they could do to try to separate us in the community.
Eugene Fowler was in his early 20s in 1968 when he became a member of the Black Liberators. The group modeled itself after the Black Panther Party, wearing black leather coats and berets, conducting military-style drills, and focusing its message on Black self-determination and empowerment. Its leader, Charles Cohen, went by Chuck. He was a charismatic speaker who had no trouble drawing in crowds.
He was cute. So the ladies surrendered around him. Anytime he had a rally, they would be there because of him, that kind of thing.
Almost everyone we spoke to about Chuck Cohen commented on his good looks. And the pictures don't lie. He had a strong jawline, choice eyewear, and a sharp-looking fro. Police weren't admirers.
Chuck was seen as the enemy because we had a Malcolm X kind of mentality. Protect your community by any means necessary.
Police targeted the Black liberators, and officers ticketed, arrested, and booked many of its members. And eyewitnesses described seeing plainclothes officers destroying the group's headquarters. Then, there's what the police did to the group's leader, Chuck Cohen, in September of 1968, when they took him to the 9th District Station.
They did what I call the old bully thing. We want to show you who the rulers are. And that's where they beat him.
Chuck and his number two, Leon Dent, were pulled over because their brake lights weren't working. The traffic stop turned into an arrest, and the two were booked at the 9th District Station. Shortly after arriving, police said they were attacked, and one officer was hospitalized with a concussion. But Chuck said police attacked first. He told a newspaper reporter that a cop grabbed him by his collar, threw him across the room, and beat him with a nightstick. He said he didn't know how long the beating lasted because he passed out. Eugene remembers seeing Chuck afterwards.
He looked like somebody that had been beaten and hoped to die. And excuse my voice, because I don't take too well for the mere fact that the recalling of him bothers me.
The front pages of local newspapers reported that Chuck was hospitalized with broken hands and deep cuts to his scalp. Word of the beating spread. Protesters rallied outside the mayor's house. Both Black and white community leaders spoke out. And with pressure building, top brass decided they would discipline the officers involved.
There was a final resolution indicating that there was excessive force used.
James Buchanan, the Black officer who joined the department just a few years earlier, remembers how the news was received.
The white officers were enraged with this decision.
After the announcement, more than 200 police officers met on a muddy baseball field. They talked about forming a union, one that would protect them, specifically, from discipline like this. St. Louis police officers had tried to form a union before, but Missouri's Board of Police Commissioners, which oversaw the department, had denied their application. The board worried a police strike could jeopardize public safety. But this time, after that incident at the 9th District Station, politicians got involved, expressing their support for the union. Soon, the state legislature passed a law saying police were allowed to organize.
There was so much political persuasion that when they made the application, they were granted the right to form a police union, which they later became known as the St. Louis Police Officers Association.
Yep. This is how the St. Louis Police Union formed. White officers beat Black activists, pushed back against accountability, and then organized to protect each other. As for the incident at the 9th District Station, officers didn't end up getting punished after all. And both Chuck Cohen and Leon Dent were found guilty for assault. Throughout the 60s, police unions were forming all across the country. Researchers have found that many got their start like the one in St. Louis, as a direct response to calls for accountability. James Buchanan had no desire to join this new union. He became a cop to try and change the status quo, not protect it.
I felt as an individual officer acting in a professional and moral way that I would make a difference. Unfortunately, that was a mission of trying to empty the ocean with a teacup. It's just a mission impossible.
He realized he couldn't do it alone. In fact, years before the union formed, Buchanan and a few like-minded black officers got together. They started meeting in his mother's living room, trying to organize their own group.
We wanted to address discrimination, excessive force, and the problem of hiring and promotions. The problem that we surmised was institutionalized racism.
So he and 14 fellow officers began the process of starting St. Louis's very own Black Police Union. And when word got out,
we just became known as the Doom 15.
Buchanan battled for years, and finally in 1972, his group, the Ethical Society of Police, won formal recognition. Today, there are dozens of Black police associations like it across the country. Groups that try to protect Black officers from discrimination and push for police reform. For Buchanan, it came at a cost. He says he was denied promotions for his role in the organization, like when he led protests against the police department for unequal hiring practices. In 1988, he retired as a sergeant. And after 20 years of fighting to change the police department from within, Buchanan says he came to realize that the problem was something much bigger than just the St. Louis Police Department.
Until we really get down to the real nitty-gritty of what that is, there will never, ever be a solution because we can never talk about the problem. And the problem is the problem of white supremacy in this country. It has its tentacles attached to every aspect of American society.
A lot of those battles James Buchanan started fighting for back in the 70s, they're still going on.
How much has changed between the original formation of Ethical versus right now? I think a lot of the things are pretty much the same.
Heather Taylor served as president of the Ethical Society of Police from 2015 to 2020 and just retired after 20 years on the force, most recently as a homicide detective. Heather says Black officers still feel like outsiders in their department.
You're talking about decades later, but you still have the same problems, the same things that exist along racial lines.
In her time as president of the Ethical Society of Police, Heather publicly called out fellow officers for corruption, and she fought with police brass over reforms, even calling on the police chief to resign. She went against the so-called Blue Code of Silence, publishing a 100-page report documenting racism within the department. That angered some of her fellow officers, in person and online. On Facebook, one colleague's wife said she wanted Heather to bleed out and die. The post was liked by fellow officers.
Came up with, a list of things that we needed to change in the police department, and they didn't like it. People like to say we're all blue. No, I'm Black. I am Black. I'm not blue. And furthermore, blue is not a person, but Black is.
She even got pushback when she advocated for less controversial changes. Heather says there's one simple reason why the police union keeps resisting reforms and accountability.
It's about control. You have this power and you're losing this power. Now they want everybody to wear cameras. Now they're going to bring in social workers to help us. That means change because they want to stay the same.
With more than 1,200 paid members, most of them white, the St. Louis Police Officers Association makes political endorsements and backs those endorsements with donations to candidates who then push police-friendly legislation.
We see that this union has this power that they shouldn't have, and this power is hurting marginalized people the most in our community. We're trying to change this.
We spent months trying to interview police union leaders and hear their side of the story. Shortly before airtime, Jay Schroeder agreed to talk. He's been the president of the St. Louis Police Officers Association since 2019 and has been a cop in the city for the last 16 years. We spoke to him about systemic racism in the department, including an annual study that shows Black drivers are nearly twice as likely to be stopped as white drivers.
That's always been
a hard thing for me to wrap my head around is using the racial profiling data that comes out every year to, I guess, quantify that racism part of it.
We also asked about criticism from the Ethical Society of Police, about inequity in recruiting, and use of excessive force against Black residents.
People always say there's systemic racism in the police department. How? Tell me what is systemic and what is the racism in the police department? I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm just naive.
He said he wasn't familiar with the history of the union's founding or the incident at the 9th District Station. And he rejected accusations that the police union is anti-reform or anti-accountability, despite the union's opposition to measures like the Civilian Oversight Board. We asked if he or the union had ever publicly condemned one of its members, even in the case of an officer-involved shooting. He said no. He explained that the union's job is not to condemn cops or stick up for them, but to protect their legal rights.
This statement all the time that the big bad white police union is always out just defending bad cops is not true. We're giving people their due process rights. And that's what everyone deserves. And that's what everyone should get. No matter what you're accused of, you should be able to have legal defense. And that's what we provide.
Jay says this is about a few bad apples. But reformers like James Buchanan and Heather Taylor point to the apple orchard. They say the whole thing needs to change. This story was produced by Reveal's Najeeb Amini. Coming up, we go back to Kayla Reed, the community organizer who found that police reforms weren't working.
It's been a really big week in St. Louis. This race really comes down to turnout and making sure that North City turns out.
The police union used to drive politics in St. Louis, but not anymore. How Kayla helped flip that script, that's next on Reveal.
If you like what we do and you want to help, well, it's pretty simple. Just write us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's easy and only takes a few seconds. Just open the Apple Podcasts app on your phone, search for Reveal, then scroll down to where you see Write a Review. And there, tell them how much you love the host. Your review makes it easier for listeners to find us. And, well, it really does make a difference. And if you do it, you will get a personal thank you from me, like right now, like thank, wait, not him, not no, you. Yes, you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Camille Stanley in for Elle Lutzen. Earlier in the show, we told you about Kayla Reed. She was in her early 20s when Michael Brown was killed just a mile from where she lived. Night after night, Kayla attended protests, and soon she was organizing them. She became a leading voice in the fight for police reforms, like that civilian oversight board we told you about earlier. But in St. Louis, police kept killing Black people. So Kayla started looking for a different way to change policing. She set out to strip the police union of its influence and began transforming herself into a political queenmaker. Reporter Rebecca Rivas, with our partner the Missouri Independent, has been following Kayla's journey over the last 6 years. Rebecca takes the story from here.
When the Ferguson uprising began, I was reporting for the St. Louis American, one of the largest Black newspapers in the country. There were multiple protests a day for months on end. And I don't remember when I first met Kayla Reed. I just remember that all of a sudden, she was everywhere. Others saw her as leader of Ferguson's protest movement even before she did.
we walked into this meeting and I was like, I called this meeting. I don't know what I'm supposed to tell these people. I am not a protest leader. I am just trying to help people stay safe. You know, like, what am I supposed to be doing?
She told the story on a podcast she co-hosts. In the early days of the Ferguson protests, Kayla called a meeting and protest leader Brittany Packnett Cunningham walked in. She had a poster-sized pad of paper, and she asked Kayla what her plan was.
I was like, damn, that's a big-ass post-it note. And she was like, what's the plan? And I was like, I'm going to be honest. I don't have one. And she, like, whipped off this piece of paper and made a, like, agenda on this piece of paper. And I was like, who is this? Like, this is great. I want to do this. I was like, yeah, how did you do that? Where you get the big-ass post-it notes from? Right.
These days, Kayla leads so many meetings. She keeps those big post-it notes in her trunk all the time. From 2014 to 2016, Kayla fought for police reforms, but kept hitting walls. Well, one main wall, the police union, which had been a political powerhouse in St. Louis for nearly half a century.
They engaged in the political process to get elected officials who believe in the blue wall of silence.
Kayla was young, 26, and barely thought of herself as a leader. Going up against the union was never going to be a fair fight. But that didn't stop her.
Okay, well, we're ready to get started. Kayla Reed is an organizer with the organization.
In June 2016, Kayla organized a debate for candidates running for city prosecutor. She was trying to flip the script on the police union by becoming a political player, too. The event drew hundreds of young people, which never happens in this kind of race.
So please give Ms. Kayla Reed a round of applause. Kayla, would you stand?
Kayla knew that the next city prosecutor would play a big role in holding the police accountable. So she co-sponsored the event with a coalition of faith organizations, unions, and criminal justice reformers who were looking for a candidate willing to go after the police.
This question is for you, Ms. Gardner. What did you mean in your response when you said, by the new reality of criminal prosecution in a post-Ferguson era?
Well, we talk about what happened after Ferguson. We heard many people say we have to do something different. So Jennifer Joyce, you know, I respect
one of the candidates,
office,
Kim Gardner, said time, things others didn't, like that we needed to tear down the criminal justice system and address the root causes of crime. A month later, Kayla rallied the coalition to throw their support behind Kim Gardner.
We decided to say, well, how can we put our hands on the scale? We're organizers. We talk to people. We mobilize them to action. Can we mobilize them to take an action and vote a particular way?
It worked. Gardner won the election, becoming the first African-American to hold the seat. The union led an aggressive campaign against her. She won without their endorsement. I spoke to Gardner about that moment. She told me that even before she took office, leaders at the police union started pushing back.
And individuals basically said, now that you've won, what are you going to do for the police? And gave me a list of directives that if I did not adhere to these directives of never holding a police accountable, making them feel like they can do whatever, in so many words, I'm paraphrasing, they would make sure I'll never get elected again. They would make sure my job is difficult. And they would make sure that basically there was repercussions. And that's what has happened day one.
Jay Schroeder wasn't the president of the police union back then. But when we talked to him about Gardner's claim, he said he didn't think it was true. What we do know is that within a year, the police union was in court arguing that Gardner couldn't investigate officers for excessive use of force. That case went all the way up to the Missouri Supreme Court. Gardner won the case. She wanted to take over investigating cases of police misconduct and excessive force instead of letting police investigate themselves. Kayla wanted that too, but they needed an ally in the mayor's office. For Kayla, Tashara Jones, the city's treasurer, was the woman for the job. And the primary was just 5 months away.
1,500 people came to the debate. She walked out the clear winner when we did an exit poll. We did a lot of digital organizing. We did some field work, fundraising, etc. She was doing so well.
Less than a year after wading into city politics, Kayla had a real shot at getting a new mayor elected. But it didn't work out.
You see the numbers there. Tashara Jones actually came in second. She lost by less than 2% to Cruz. And also, of course, many folks don't...
Tashara lost by less than 900 votes. Kayla was crushed.
It was hard because I thought we did everything we could do. I mean, now I realize we didn't do much of anything that we could do.
In that 2017 mayor's race, Kayla thinks they knocked on about 1,000 doors. If they were going to become real political players, they needed to bulk up. Because in a year, there was an election Kayla was not willing to lose.
I knew the minute I started doing elections that 2018 was going to be on my radar because we needed to take out Bob McCullough. He needed to be gone.
Bob McCullough was the county prosecutor. He managed the grand jury process after Ferguson, where they chose not to indict Darren Wilson for killing Michael Brown.
I said at the time, a glass of water could have ran against Bob McCullough. And I would have campaigned for it.
It was a harder lift than the mayor's race because St. Louis County is more conservative than the Democratic city it borders. Bob McCullough was the status quo candidate who had been in office since 1991. So it shocked the region when Kayla's candidate, Wesley Bell, won the race. The election happened on August 7th, 2018, almost 4 years to the day after Michael Brown was killed, making Wesley Bell the first African-American to be elected prosecutor for St. Louis County. Across the country, as more African-Americans were killed by police, people started looking to Kayla and the group she co-founded, Action St. Louis, for guidance. Leaders in cities including Minneapolis, Detroit, and Miami reached out to Kayla's group, wanting to know how they could make change happen in their cities faster.
Now what we're seeing is folks are kind of skipping that stage that Ferguson went through, this like reform period. And they're like, okay, we saw that that didn't work. How do we get to where you are quicker with rethinking the way that we define safety and starting to line up our budget to those demands?
On a Saturday morning in March, Kayla greets a group of volunteers at a park in North St. Louis. The election for mayor is just a month away, and Kayla is again trying to get Tashara Jones elected.
It's a great day to get Tashara Jones promoted in the Fifth Ward.
She gives them a pep talk before everyone spreads out to canvass a major Black neighborhood.
It's been a really big week in St. Louis, and this race really comes down to turnout and making sure that North City turns out.
Kayla's group has been knocking on 1,000 doors a day, unlike the 1,000 doors total they knocked on in 2017. As the election was heating up, I spoke to Tashara Jones about the role that Kayla and Action St. Louis are playing in the mayor's race. She told me Kayla's group is becoming a make-or-break force in St. Louis politics.
Citywide, no one matches their ground game. No one matches their effort. And so they are becoming the endorsement to have or the backing to have in order to get elected.
If she wins, Tashara has committed to creating an independent unit to investigate officer-involved shootings. And she told me she plans to go through the public safety budget with a fine-tooth comb.
We spend $250 million on public safety every year. And what is our return on that investment?
Tashara wants to defund the police, meaning that she wants to take some money away from policing and put it towards things she believes get at the root causes of crime, like affordable housing, jobs, healthcare, and services for mental health and drug addiction.
I think the police are terrified of Tashara Jones's candidacy because they see her like they see Black protesters.
That is my most poetic statement.
We are now drinking.
To movement.
It's Tuesday, April 6th, election night. The polls closed about an hour ago. Kayla and her team are gathered at their office for a celebratory drink after months of hard work.
4 years ago, we lost, and for 4 years, we have built.
And I hope that tonight, when Tashara wins, if she wins, Lord, let her win, that folks know that movement did it.
She says they knocked on 25,000 doors, made over 230,000 calls, and sent about 100,000 text messages. They're hoping it'll be enough.
Ooh, that's close.
For more than an hour, Kayla and her team click refresh on laptops and phones, hoping for election results. Eventually, she gets on a Zoom with other organizers around town, trying to get intel.
Tashara is less than 1,000 ahead. I'm trying to figure out what's still out.
I know. That's what I was just getting deets on. And what I was told is that all except for 12 are still out.
At 9:30, results are in.
I see final unofficial results.
Wait, where? Drop the link. Just drop the link. Just drop the link.
She won.
Tashara Jones won. She'll be the first Black woman to lead the city. Kayla's covering her face. She's crying. Her partner's holding her.
Yeah, Kayla, you did it, Kayla. Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.
I am crying because I just remember what it felt like. And so much is possible.
More than 6 years ago, Ferguson launched a movement. And slowly, piece by piece, it's changing this city.
She won. She won. Dear God.
Tashara Jones took office on April 20th. Kayla is part of her transition team.
That story was reported by Rebecca Rivas from our partners at the Missouri Independent. Earlier in the show, we told you about Heather Taylor, who used to run the Ethical Society of Police, the Black police union here in St. Louis. Since taking office, Mayor Jones has tapped Heather to help lead the city's public safety department. But while St. Louis is poised to make big changes to policing, the Missouri State Legislature is expected to pass a bill that would make that harder, one that could prevent municipalities from cutting public safety budgets. It's a direct response to the kinds of reforms promised in St. Louis. The legislation also includes a so-called Bill of Rights for law enforcement officers. It does things like limit the length of police misconduct investigations, which even the police chief in St. Louis says would make it harder to hold officers accountable. If you want to hear more stories about complex people, places, and systems, check out the podcast my team makes at Witness Docs from Stitcher. Our lead producer for this week's show is Najib Amini. Rhett Myers edited the show with help from Andy Donahue and Taki Telenides. Kenya Vaughn provided editorial support for today's show. Thanks also to Fred Sweets at the St. Louis American and to Jason Hancock at the Missouri Independent. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Score and sound design by Jim Briggs and Fernando Aruda. They had help this week from Brett Simpson and Amita Ganatra. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our acting CEO is Annie Schabel. Sumi Agarwal is our interim editor-in-chief. And our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Inasmuch Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Camille Stanley, filling in for Al Letson, who ends every show with. And remember, there's always more to the story. Yeah, that was fun.